everyone. It's Thursday, November 11th, and you are listening to Against the Current, brought to you by CITR 101.9 FM's News Collective. We aim to bring you an alternative and undercover current affairs coverage from Vancouver and Lower Mainland every Thursday at 3 p.m. We're based on UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. It is important to acknowledge whose land we are on and who has been taking care of our land for centuries. I'm Trish Mahant.
I'm Yuna Sasser.
I'm Tiffany Ma.
I'm Hannah Het.
We have a packed show for you again this week. Today, we are talking about technology and smart spaces with Patrick Lecomte. We also interviewed Dr. Richard Redan about Indigenous Veterans Day. And lastly, we talked to Megan Tweedy about the BC Civil Liberties Association's lawsuit against long-term solitary confinement. First, let's hear from Tiffany.
Technology and smart spaces. With the rise of technologies like cloud computing, real-time navigation devices, and personalized advertisement based on your most recent online purchases, many people now have raised concerns over data privacy and having their personal information misused by third parties. This week, I sat down with Dr. Patrick Lecomte, professor in real estate at the University of Quebec in Montreal. Dr. Lecomte has spent 12 years in Singapore teaching real estate finance and had also conducted research on Asian commercial real estate markets. In this interview, we talked about the future of smart cities, digital rights, and reflect on how we interact with technology as we emerge from this year of pandemic.
Yeah, just to get us started, Patrick, do you mind telling us what you do and why did you get interested in real estate and especially smart spaces in particular?
Sure. So what I do, I'm an academic researcher and a professor at UQAM, so Université du Québec à Montréal. I'm quite new in Canada. I moved to Canada only in early 2021, so earlier this year. And I spent more than 10 years in Singapore, in Asia. And why do I work in real estate? I mean, you know, life decides really, I mean, your topic of research. And initially, I started working in finance. I trained to be investment manager. I was at Columbia University in New York. And through life, I decided basically to change my career and to become more into to research. And when it comes to research, I feel that real estate offers a lot of opportunities because it's an alternative asset. So it's very unique. It's both financial and physical. So I was always interested in that. And so here I am. Why do I work on smart buildings? And you mentioned smart space, which is a concept basically introduced in my research. I mean, that's a very good question, actually. In 2015, I started really to hear a lot about smart buildings when I was in Singapore. I mean, Singapore is a smart city, so everything is smart. It was really like being bombarded by news, by information, by reports, especially reports by consulting firms. But I was not feeling very comfortable about all that because I felt that there was something which was missing, which was basically the thinking behind it. What does it mean for us? What does it mean for human beings? I mean, it's all very nice to focus on the technological and all the, you know, the wonders of technology, but what is the essence of all that for what I'm doing for real estate and ultimately for basically building occupants, i.e. for human beings?
One common kind of pushback against, you know, mm-hmm. using these smart technology, mm-hmm. Like smart grids, all that would be the concern of digital privacy. So I'm just wondering, as an expert yourself, how do you address these kind of concerns and what kind of like property rights concept would you offer on the table?
Yeah, so you mentioned property rights with privacy. I mean, for me, those two concepts are totally linked. And let me go back to this concept of space. So we have physical space where we live, and as I said, as a species, I mean, human beings and all the, I mean, all life we have on Earth basically is linked to this physical space. And this physical space is being invaded by a new type of space, which is digital space. So when we go online, basically, we go on digital space. So we have this interface, which is a computer, a smartphone, and this is basically a gateway to digital space. Digital space is coming into physical space without those gateways through a technology which is called pervasive computing, which is the next paradigm of computing. And because of that, basically, we have new problems in real estate, and privacy is one of those problems. But it's not limited to buildings per se. Actually, the issue of privacy in smart environment has been mentioned in the literature about smart cities, smart urbanism, smart environment. And in my opinion, basically, the issue is not so much about privacy. The issue is really about control. And this is what I mentioned in the short piece for the conversation. Basically, it's not so much about being invaded in terms of what you are doing, is being told, it's being led to do something. And basically, that's why all my analysis is very phenomenological insofar as I really focus on behavior as a unit of measure, basically, for those smart buildings. It's all about controlling behaviors. And that's why the model defined by Heidegger, this phenomenological model of Dasein, so this being in space, is extremely important for me, because from this model, I define the concept of digital surrounding world, which is basically our environment, all the interaction we have with space. And all those interactions are part of our privacy. But privacy is, in my opinion, is too reductive as a concept. It goes way, way, way beyond that. It's about behavior. As I said, you have those two spaces. You have the physical space, so you are geolocated in a physical space. They know how much time you spend in which store in the mall, so they can infer that you are looking for this or for that in the mall. And on the other hand, you have the digital space. So you might have searched for goods online, or you might have done some search or chat with your friend on this and that, or you might have liked pictures on Facebook, or you might have watched video on YouTube about, you know, this type of goods or this type of lifestyle. And basically, the two merge. And when the two merge, basically, this is where the problem happens. And it will happen more and more, and even more, you know, in a much smarter way than it does today, thanks to the new technology that is being implemented. And the issue really is that there is nothing illegal about it, because in effect, unknowingly or possibly because you didn't read all the details, we all gave our consent for this to happen. There is no informed consent. You don't know what you are giving away. And in effect, you are giving away a resource. What is this resource? This resource is the way you interact with your space, the way you basically, your being in space is being taken from you, and you gave your consent unknowingly. So it's really, really a big problem. And the reason why it happens is because there are no properly defined property right regime.
So before we end, I do have to ask this one last question that's super relevant right now, would be, so for the COVID pandemic, after a year and a half in lockdown, and, you know, we kind of rely on technology a lot more, and kind of we relate to technology a lot differently in terms of Zoom and kind of like restaurants having online menus and everything. How do you think this concept of smart space and property rights would kind of define our relationship with space going forward?
Well, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, the COVID pandemic has been, really a big opportunity for tech companies, and just look at their profits. I mean, they've never been that big. COVID, in a way, has redefined the way we interact with technology, and we realize that actually we can survive thanks to technology. So it has made technology even more part of our lives. But as soon as we go back to basically to space outside, I mean, to the office, to shopping malls, basically we will not necessarily notice that things have changed, but things have changed. And there is one very, very big reason for that, is that for 2 years, basically, all those landlords of very expensive properties did not make much money because, I mean, of course, there are tenants there to pay rent, but basically the properties were empty. So nobody wants to have an empty building. I mean, there is no point owning a building when it's empty. It's not the same problem if you are, if you are Google or Facebook or the other big tech company, because even if you are not involved in space, in physical space, you can still make money in digital space. But for anybody involved in physical space, COVID has been, in a way, wake-up call. So what can we do? And COVID also, as being the pandemics, has been a catalyst for even going faster into the implementation of technology. So there was a study which was done by Siemens. So Siemens, a German engineering company. And so they asked 2 weeks ago, 75 real estate executives in large companies, so people in charge of office buildings, office spaces, factories, and all that, how they reacted faced with COVID. And almost 100% of them basically said that they've increased their investment in technology. Technology for occupancy, so those sensors we talked about that would be put under your desk, but also technology for movement, technology for knowing what employees are doing, within the limit, of course, of data privacy and all those things. COVID has been extremely important for the industry.
Thank you, Dr. Patrick Lacombe, for coming on the show this week. If you're interested in knowing more about Dr. Lacombe's work, check out his most recent published article on the news outlet The Conversation, titled Get Ready for the Invasion of Smart Building Technologies Following COVID-19.
The haunting debut album Black Moon by Civic TV provides a cinematic backdrop, a modern-day symphony of the dark and light that is our collective reality. Take a listen to Black Moon, now available via Flemish Eye Records and on all streaming platforms.
Slice of Life Art and Gift Shop is Vancouver's choicest destination for one-of-a-kind artist-made prints, posters, screen prints, riso prints, paintings, acrylic paintings, watercolor paintings, ceramic mugs, ceramic plates, ceramic bowls, ceramic pots, lapel pins, hats, toques, crochet bathing suits, jewelry, trinkets, knickknacks, hand-painted signs, curated thrift, and a bunch more stuff that won't fit in this designated block of airtime. Slice of Life Art and Gift Shop, located at 1636 Venables, just off Commercial, open 11 to 6, 6 days a week.
Welcome back to Against the Current, your source of alternative and undercover news from the Lower Mainland. You just heard Patrick Lacombe talking about technology and smart spaces in his interview with Tiffany. Now, in light of Indigenous Veterans Day and Remembrance Day, let's talk about Indigenous participation in Canadian military history. It is estimated that at least 12,000 First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people served in the three large wars of the 20th century, and at least 500 of those people lost their lives. After the First World War, some Indigenous soldiers were recognized and decorated for their participation, but many were forgotten. Therefore, it's important to remember and commemorate the Indigenous lives lost and forgotten during the wars. And today, Trish and I talked to Dr. Richard Vidan to discuss Indigenous Veterans Day and Indigenous participation in the Great Wars. Dr. Vidan is a member of the Sequitmik First Nation in Central Interior, BC. He is a professor emeritus at UBC's School of Social Work, and in the past, he was director of the First Nations House of Learning and senior advisor to the President on Aboriginal Affairs. He currently serves as the Elder Scholar for UBC's School of Social Work and SFU's Faculty of Education. He served in the Canadian Armed Forces for 11 years, and his father and grandfather served in the World Wars. Here is our interview with Dr. Richard Vidan.
Thank you, Dr. Vidan, for joining us today. So our first question to you today is, what does Indigenous Veterans Day mean to you?
Okay, it's... It is a recognition that the circumstance of Indigenous veterans, young men and women who served on behalf of Canada, the circumstance were not regarded as citizens of the country, and for the most part didn't have the right to vote during the time which we served. So it's important that that be recognized, and that is being recognized on November the 8th. For example, I give an example of my father Hector, who enlisted at the age of 17 in 1940 as a residential school survivor and served overseas in Italy, France, Germany, and Holland, and didn't return home for 30 years because of back to his home territory, because of the shame he'd felt as a residential school survivor. Also because he was not regarded as a citizen, and again, not having the vote till 1960. And we shared on November 8th this year, as I have been for the last 20 years, I met in some of the people there were members of the Chinese Canadian veterans who share a similar history in terms of citizenship and the vote. And we also have a relationship with the Tuskegee Airmen, the African-American squadron that still exists. And so it's important to recognize the discrepant circumstance, and also to recognize that Native Indians, Indigenous First Nations, Inuit, Métis, served of all the identifiable groups in Canada, First Nations, Inuit, Métis served as a higher proportion than any other identifiable group. And among the 2,500 currently serving, it's a disproportionately high representation. Good. Push down.
Yeah, thank you so much. Our next question is about Indigenous participation being forgotten or deliberately not taught in high school curriculums. So what do you think is the impact of leaving such a massive part of history out of Canadian military history?
Well, we don't know our history, particularly the more unsavory parts are skipped over. And I think back, you know, to the 1700s, when Joseph Brant and the Six Nations of the Iroquois Confederacy fought on support of the British, and at the Battle of the Plains of Abraham and the Battle of 1812. That part of the history is not taught, as is the part the history of the residential schools, the reserve system, the potlatch law. And until that history is understood and appreciated, and until Canadians, all Canadians, regardless of background, situate themselves with that history, that individuals who come to Canada choose Canada, and that's a marvelous place to live. It's among, you know, the best places in the world to live, except if you're currently Indigenous, where, you know, the United Nations Human Development Index, I think, ranks Canada now. We used to be number one in the turn of the millennia. I think we were eighth, and now I think we're approximately 13th. But First Nations are ranked at 75th in terms of quality of life. So we're less First Nations, Inuit, Métis, living in urban settings or in rural reserves, are living in conditions less than many third world countries. And we see that with the boil water advisories and all of the, you know, the housing issues, and also the overrepresentation of you know, poor health, lesser education, overrepresentation in the criminal justice system. And we need to get back to what were those circumstances that led to the, you know, to that. And it's not going to be easy to do, because as Canadians get close to the uncomfortable part, the tendency is to back away because it is painful. And until we work through the pain, and it's going to be an ongoing grinding pain that is soul destroying.
And I think you mentioned this very briefly in the first question about Indigenous people not having the right to vote. So we just wanted to ask you, what happened to Indigenous soldiers when they returned home from war?
When Well, after the War of the 1700s in the Haudenosaunee people, they were, Joseph Brant was given the Haldimand County Treaty Reserve was 6 miles of land on either side of the Grand River, most of southwestern Ontario. That was transferred. That largest reserve is no longer, has been eroded. So that land has been sold, and this farm, again, you may be aware of the Caledonia issues around land claims in Caledonia, in Brantford area. When First Nations went to the First World War, they came back, and they were not afforded any of the Veterans Land Act, that other Canadian veterans had. They were not entitled to any educational benefits. In fact, 350 square miles of what was deemed by Indian Affairs to be surplus Indian land reserve was sold to returning veterans. Aboriginal veterans such as Francis Pegamolo, Tom Longboat, members of the Head of the Lake Band, could not apply for that. So there were those discrepancies. My grandfather, my relatives who would be my grandfather's age, my grandmother's age, came back to a time when the government of Canada was starting to implement the more draconian measures of the Indian Act. Many First Nations veterans from the First World War had been in, they would have been the second or third generation to go to residential school, but they still had some, they had been socialized into traditional life to a great extent, and their children and grandchildren, people like myself. But when they came back, the Potlatch Law was put into full effect, which meant just the three of us having this conversation until 1951, where I'm a person, certainly at 77, I'm over 50 years of age, and I'm telling traditional stories, we'd all spend 6 months in Ocala prison, because that was against the law. The laws that made it a legal obligation for people to surrender, parents to surrender their children to the residential school, became into effect. The amendment to the Indian Act, which made it illegal for First Nations to hire a lawyer to address land claims. The law which made it illegal to discuss land claims or to have any gathering to discuss land claims, and for a period of time to have any discussion whatsoever. Those are the things that happened during the 20s. So the individuals who went to war and then came back, they did take up some leadership roles, but then they saw they were helpless. They were impotent to prevent their children from going to school. And having gone to school themselves, the residential school themselves, and been subjected to the atrocities, the abuse, the physical, sexual, emotional, spiritual abuse, they turned, that turned inwardly to depression, to self-medication. They were no longer things such as the Potlatch Law, which was the church, which was the traditional church, the social support were stripped away. So there was no healthy outlet for all of the stress, and people turned to unhealthy means and turned against each other. And the same thing for in the Second World War. My father Hector, we grew up in Haudenosaunee territory outside Hamilton, because he didn't come back to Williams Lake area for 30 years. I had classmates whose parents were veterans, non-native, and they had very nice houses on quarter-acre lots to the Veterans Land Act. And my father Hector had none of that. Some of them had gone to university. Some of my classmates' parents had gone to university with the support from the Veterans Affairs. My father had none of that. So again, those inequities.
Right, yeah. And are Indigenous veterans being treated any better today, or would you say that they're still facing a lot of the same problems?
There's still a great deal of inequities. There's already been, there were some reparations made My father, Hector, passed some years ago. He just didn't have the will or desire. He'd been disappointed so many, he didn't even bother applying. Right now, it's Canada is not treating any of its veterans in a in an equitable manner, regardless of whether they're Indigenous veterans or veterans from all communities. When you have young men, people of your age coming back with physical, you know, wounded, you know, with physical injuries, spiritual, emotional injuries, and having to fight for benefits, having to fight for, you know, for the support, being told until recently, you've lost a limb to an exploded device, and at your age you have to take this lump sum of money and never return, not knowing you're in your early 20s, the impact that may have on your lives when you're 30, 20, 30, 40 years from now, when that will certainly exacerbate your quality of life, and also your, you know, have complications for physical health. So yeah, I don't mean to be, I get animated about this because Canada, I think there's need to go into harm's way and to remedy, you know, Canada has a great international reputation as peacekeepers. But when we put young people such as yourselves, we invite them to go into harm's way and to protect, they're entitled to have the best equipment and the best training and to be assured that when they return, that they will be taken care of. And when they're, that their families will be taken care of. And that is not the case today.
We believe that you attended Vancouver's remembrance event.
I did, yes.
Could you talk about the significance of that?
It, again, as always, it was a very moving event where it was at a reduced scale. And that's been the Squamish First Nation, Rob Nahini, who's a veteran. He served, and he and his family have been the organizers of that, along with the Tsleil-Waututh and the Musqueam, also people where I'm here in Tsawwassen. So having people come together, and there were representatives, all three levels of government, and both Vancouver Police Department, unions were represented. So it was good to have that recognition and to bring, there's few of us now, most of us, my age, I'm getting up there, but there's many of the World War II veterans there in their 90s, and they attend as best they can. But it's good to come together to have a chance to visit. Of course, with the COVID pandemic, that's taken its issues. But it was important that people, non-Aboriginal people, government people, do take the time and to spend time with us. And that means a great deal. We had all of the Hedy Fry, the mayor of Vancouver, and other people who spoke, and that goes, that is noticed, but it needs to be accompanied by ongoing support. And Remembrance Day isn't just one day of year. The people live, the veterans live 365 days a year with the consequences of their service. And I also add that one of the best ways that people can remember the sacrifices that veterans made, regardless of whether it's Aboriginal or non-Aboriginal, all veterans, to honor those veterans by, at times of whether it's municipal elections, provincial elections, federal elections, exercise the right to vote. And it's rather shameful that when there are elections, it's a very reduced, people are not participating in the democracy that was so hard won. And we can't take those things for granted. And I would hope that one of the other ways that we can honor our veterans and their contributions, is to get to a point in time when conflict among individuals, conflict between individuals, conflict between communities, conflict between nations can be resolved in a way which doesn't, we don't resort to the most basic physical violence. We haven't learned a great deal, and we need to get to that point where no one, it's no longer necessary for any children, anyone's children, to go into harm's way to protect what we have. Most would say, I know my father, Hector, and other veterans, when I was in the Air Force in the 60s and 70s, many of the people were of my father's age. They knew the realities of what many of you people, young people your age, who perhaps are from countries where there is currently conflict, know the horrors of war. There's nothing romantic about it, and they were pacifists because they knew what the consequence, the gut-wrenching realities of what war, what violence meant.
Mm-hmm. And you've touched on this a little bit before, but would you mind sharing yours or perhaps your father's or your grandfather's experience of serving in the Canadian Armed Forces as an Indigenous person?
I'll speak with respect to my father, Hector, as I have. My father, Hector, he was born Hector Peters, the Clinton Band, 1923. He was grandmother married into the Sugarcane Band in Williams Lake, but my father Hector was by law, he was required to go to the Indian Residential School at St. Joseph's Mission in Williams Lake, which he did for 3 years until he contracted rheumatic fever. He was bedridden with the rheumatic fever and was cared for by his grandparents, Johnny Peters and Catherine Peters. And then spent time in Williams Lake and moved off reserve because the reserve is only 7 miles from the town of Williams Lake. And he was working in the town of Williams Lake and was basically told that because he was native and there was a good worker, his boss had to let him go because people are asking, why is there an Indian working when there's white men that need jobs? And he and his buddy Frank Lindley happened to be in the pool hall, and the recruiting sergeant came along, and Hector was, my father used his a cousin's name, Vidan, and added 2 years to his age. He was told me he was 19, not 17, and enlisted in the Rocky Mountain Rangers. And in 19, a year or so later, they route marched from Kamloops. Over 2 weeks, they went from Kamloops to Merritt to Spencer's Bridge down the Fraser Canyon to Vancouver, carrying a 60-pound pack. I joined the Royal Canadian Air Force when I was 22. And it wasn't until my son, Tim, who's now 50, it wasn't until he turned 17 that it really struck me what it would have been like for my father at age 17 to join. So every time I drive into Kamloops, I go home to my territory, you come over the rise and down the slope, you see that big red brick building where that's the residential school. They discovered the unmarked graves and many of my relatives there. I think of my father, Hector, coming there to, he didn't know where he was going. He went overseas. His relatives, his parents were not happy with him going, but when they understood he was going to go, they said, well, we'll send some ancestors with you to protect you, meaning they were going to send good medicine with him. And he served in Italy. He was at Melfort, he was the Royal Westminster Regiment of Canada. In fact, I have a good friend, Major Ben Pong, who's the deputy commanding officer. He's also a Chinese Canadian. He's not a veteran, he's still serving in. I was very pleased to be able to introduce the two of them, both Westminster. My father was at Melfort River when his commanding officer, John Manny, won the Victoria Cross. and he was at other places. He wouldn't talk. On rare occasions, he would not talk about what he's experienced. When he did, he told some really horrific stories, but he wanted to keep them, you know, he thought he was protecting us. And he came back, he didn't go home, he tried to, he was ashamed of his, of being Indian. So for the growing up, it was never something we discussed. He worked really hard, and that's what I learned from him, is to being focused, but also that, you know, that life is serious, and we need to, but also we need to have fun, and we need to have joy. And I spent earlier this week or last week, I spent time with students from Shaughnessy Elementary, grade five students, and they made orange poppies, red poppies and eagle feathers that they put on display at the city hall. And I was, there were children from all four directions, all, you know, very quite children from all around the world. And I was struck by their level of awareness, their level of insight, and their level of appreciation of what was going on. And I was concerned that, well, this is more than, you know, they need to be encouraged to be children. And to, your job is to, what grade five is to, is to study hard, but also remember to have fun and play. Towards the end of his latter few decades of my Father Hector's life, he was able to discuss. And he and I, when I was director of the House of Learning until a few years ago, I was the lodge keeper for Sweat Lodge. And he and Hector and I sat, we were in ceremony together. And that was very powerful. It had been 60 years from the time he had last sat in the Sweat Lodge with his great-grandfather. So that was and we had some good discussions. I mentioned that his relative, my grandparents, that sent some ancestor to protect my father, Hector. And there were occasions, there were a number of occasions where Hector said, you know, Dad would say he didn't know how he got out of it. And he thinks that's when the ancestors were with him. But I like to, you know, human beings were on both sides of the conflict. So there were ancestors on the NATO allies side, but there were also ancestors on the Axis power side. And under all of that, we need to remember we're all human beings. And with that, I've been some of the projects working with at UBC and the Veterans Transition is a program called The Long Shadow of War, and looking at the impact on children and grandchildren of First and Second World veterans. And it's involved children whose parents or grandparents may have served with the military of Germany, France, Canada, and England. And many of our stories are, you know, the German children, grandchildren, their stories are very much the same as they recall what their relatives experienced. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing that and sharing your knowledge and your experiences with us today.
Slice of Life Art and Gift Shop is Vancouver's choicest destination for one-of-a-kind artist-made prints, posters, screen prints, riso prints, paintings, acrylic paintings, watercolor paintings, ceramic mugs, ceramic plates, ceramic bowls, ceramic pots, lapel pins, hats, toques, crochet bathing suits, jewelry, trinkets, knickknacks, hand-painted signs, curated thrift, and a bunch more stuff that won't fit in this designated block of airtime. Slice of Life Art and Gift Shop, located at 1636 Venables, just off Commercial, open 11 to 6, 6 days a week.
Ta-ta.
Now the patriarchy is dead, and we killed it. If you identify as a woman, femme, trans, or non-binary, CITR wants you on the air. You can talk about literally whatever you want as long as you care about it. No worries if you have no experience, we'll train you in everything you need to know. Come by CITR and say hi.
Hey.
Hi.
Hello.
From 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday to Friday to help us never play Led Zeppelin on CITR 101.9 FM ever again. I could be you.
Welcome back to Against the Current, your source of alternative and undercover news from the Lower Mainland. You just heard Dr. Richard Badan talk about the Indigenous participation in World War I and the significance of Indigenous Veterans Day. For our last coverage today, let's talk about the BC Civil Liberties Association's lawsuit against the long-term solitary confinement. This week, Hannah sat down with Megan Tweedy to get to know more about this topic. Over to you, Hannah.
Thank you, Trish. So last month, the BC Civil Liberties Association, also known as BCCLA, filed a lawsuit to stop wardens at federal prisons from placing people in what is essentially long-term solitary confinement. To learn about this, I had the pleasure of speaking with Megan Tweedy, who is a senior counsel at BCCLA. In our interview, Megan explains what solitary confinement is and what it looks like in Canada. She tells me about their lawsuit and also about a fundraising panel they are hosting on November 24th to support their efforts. If listeners are interested to learn more about BCCLA and this event, they can visit their Facebook or Twitter page. But for now, please enjoy our interview.
Thank you for your time, Megan. So just to start off, I was wondering if you could explain to me what long-term solitary confinement is.
Yeah, thank you for having me. So long-term solitary confinement is essentially the isolation of someone who's in the prison system. And under the Mandela Rules, which are a set of international norms governing how we should treat people in prison, it's defined as confinement of 22 hours or more a day for 15 days or longer. And when that occurs, that's long-term solitary confinement, and it's actually recognized as torture. This is a practice that is horrifically debilitating to people. It causes or exacerbates mental illness. It can lead to self-harm and suicidal ideation. So yes, solitary confinement is something that is desperately needs to be addressed in our prison system, and we've done work to do that before.
So what does it look like in Canada? Like, what's the extent of it in Canada? I know in 2019, I think BCCLA like passed a lawsuit or like did some legislation. So I was wondering if you could go into that.
In Canada, we used to have an administrative segregation regime is what that was called, but we know it to be a solitary confinement regime. And that allowed the federal government through Correctional Services Canada, to put people in prison into isolation for long periods of time. And we're talking far exceeding what's permitted under the Mandela Rules. These practices amount to torture. This was happening through the administrative segregation regime through prisons across the country. And the BCCLA, we brought a lawsuit, as you mentioned, to challenge these laws. We were successful in striking them down in 2019. The court recognized that this was a torturous and unconstitutional practice. But unfortunately, what we're seeing is that even though that administrative segregation regime was eliminated, we're seeing the same type of solitary confinement taking place in prisons. And we're seeing that through the use of things called lockdowns and restrictive movement routines. And a lockdown essentially means that every prisoner, every person in prison is locked into their own cells and unable to go out and socialize, be in the outside world. So what we're seeing is essentially a mass solitary confinement of everyone. And what we know is that these lockdowns and restrictive movement routines, which are essentially the same thing, it places restrictions on your ability to leave your cell. We're seeing that these can go on for days, weeks, months. So it really is solitary confinement under a different name. So that's what our latest lawsuit is about, is to say, you can't just keep continuing this torturous practice by renaming it. And in fact, it's probably affecting more people because lockdowns will affect the entire prison or unit within a prison.
Mm-hmm. And do you have an idea of why it continues to happen with like different names?
Well, wardens are given certain leeway under the correctional services legislation to control prisons. So they do have the ability to order lockdowns, to set restrictive movement routines. So the law allowing them to do so is there. And that's why we're continuing to see it. But what we're seeing is an abuse of this power, and something that we say is absolutely not permitted by policy, not permitted under Canadian law. It's not constitutional. But because wardens do have discretion to say we're imposing a lockdown or we're imposing a restrictive movement routine, they can use these to lock down entire prisons, and it can make things easier for prison staff if everyone is confined to their cell. So we see lockdowns being ordered for things like staff shortages, for things like operational reasons, certainly nothing to do with the health and well-being of people in prison.
Right. And then you mentioned the lawsuit that BCCLA filed last month. Mm-hmm. Can you touch on what kind of more about the lawsuit and what you're hoping to achieve with it?
Yeah, sure. So we are continuing our work to fight against this practice. Our new lawsuit is challenging the use of lockdowns and restrictive movement routines by federal prison wardens. We're arguing that these practices, which amount to solitary confinement, unjustifiably infringe on our charter rights, specifically Section 7, Section 12, and Section 15. So we say that, first of all, state-imposed conditions that expose people to physical and psychological trauma infringe the right to liberty and security of a person. Similarly, state-imposed action that leads to suicide infringes the right to life. We know that prolonged solitary confinement is cruel and unusual punishment. So we say it violates Section 12 as well. Section 15 is our equality clause, and we see that these practices are imposing particularly egregious harm on mentally ill and disabled prisoners, racialized or Indigenous people in prison, infringing their right to equality. So our lawsuit is bringing up all of those arguments, and we're saying that these infringements simply can't be justified in a free and democratic society.
Mm-hmm. And then I'm wondering, you said that like some of the reasons why that people are put into confinement is like something like staffing shortages. Is there kind of like holistic solutions that could be put in place to prevent like something like staffing shortages from causing something like this?
Well, certainly I think we need to look at the bigger picture and look at the problem of over-incarceration. It's our view that there are simply, this system is broken, and we see the over-incarceration of people. If we were able to achieve change in the system, we would see less people in prison, less resources needing to go to prison staff, and ultimately leading to a better society. But what we're all, it's also worth noting that staff shortages are often used as an excuse when it's not necessarily like an actually justifiable reason to impose these lockdowns. We know there are alternatives.
Right. And then in later this month, on November 24th, you're hosting an event called No Justice in Isolation, Challenging Prison Conditions in Canada. So for any listeners who might be interested in this event, would you mind just explaining what will be talked about at the event and where they could learn more about it?
Yes, sure. We're very excited. We have Elle Jones as a panelist, who's a poet, journalist, and professor. We have Jen Metcalf, who's the executive director of Prisoners Legal Services, and myself as senior counsel for the BCCLA to speak about this case. We're talking about how criminalizing laws and systems extend into many aspects of our lives and particularly impact Indigenous, Black, racialized, disabled, and mentally ill people. They're being trapped in an expansive legal system, and it includes prisons and the conditions under which people are incarcerated. So we are trying to talk about how prison conditions such as solitary confinement, these don't happen in a vacuum. They're informed by intersecting civil liberties and human rights issues such as colonialism, systemic racism, classism, ableism, and more. So we're hoping to bring to light some of these issues with our panel and speak about our prison system and ways that we can affect change. So we hope to see people there. It'll be a good event.
Right. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Just to say that we think this is an incredibly important issue. What we're seeing is nothing less than torture that's occurring behind our prison walls. So we just are very passionate about moving this case forward and hope that we achieve our desired result in putting an end to this practice.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much for your time, Megan.
Thank you.
So that's our show today, folks. Thank you so much for listening. This has been Against the Current by CITR News. We are here every Thursday at 3 p.m. bringing you local news.